Hi, my name's Wendy. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. I see a friend of mine here that can come up here and tell my using story. Hey, Teresa. Anyway, there's a lot of people here tonight. I'm going to start with, I began drinking and doing drugs when I was 15. And the very first time that I drank, I got drunk. And I went into a blackout and I threw up and all that stuff that you do. And from that point on, I drank like I was alcoholic. I think that I was probably born that way. You know, I didn't know that normal people didn't have blackouts and that normal people didn't just not get drunk. I just, you know, I didn't know that. And when they told me in treatment that only alcoholics have blackouts, I'm like, well, you know, I've been having blackouts ever since the first time I drank. And I got sober when I was 20 in 89. And I drank and I did drugs for 5 years. And that's all it took for me to hit bottom. I started drinking the end of ninth grade. And by ninth grade summer, I was smoking pot, smoking hash. By 10th grade, I was having to carry alcohol in the back of my trunk and drink between classes. I had gone from an honor roll student all my life to making D's. And my parents contributed it to, you know, just going on to high school and not being happy where I was and all that kind of stuff. So instead of going to Murrah, I ended up at the Ed Center, which they used to call back then the Head Spinner, because just pretty much, you know, drug heads went there, you know. And I ended up moving out when I was 16, living with some older girls. And when I was 16, I was drinking every night, going to a bar called Dr. Feelgood's. And at that time, I started doing cocaine, doing ecstasy, doing acid, shooting dope, you know, the whole gamut there. And let's see, I've been sober longer than I drank, so I'm going to try to just kind of get through and let you identify that I am alcoholic and drug addict, and then try to talk more about what's happened to me in sobriety and how I've stayed sober. I lived with a guy for a couple of years, and I got into doing a lot of Xanax, and when I was with him, we were having to do about 10 a day just to maintain. And when he left me and moved to Florida, it's like I kind of had hit a bottom. And we had broken up, gotten back together, broken up, and he had leased an apartment in Florida, and it broke my heart. You know, we had gotten back together, and he left. He had already leased the apartment in Florida and left, and I was living by myself at that time. And he left, and I couldn't stop crying. I was like holding on. He had left his jacket, and I was like holding on to his jacket, just crying and carrying on. And a friend of mine, Alice, came to the apartment door and knocked on it, and I let her in, and she's like, God, Wendy, you know, you look like hell. You just can't live like this, you know, crying over David and all this other kind of stuff. And she said, why don't you come in and move in with Ricky and I, and we'll help take care of you, and you can help us with the rent. We got a nice apartment and all that kind of stuff. So I did. And lived with them for a while and ended up running into my first boyfriend, Sean, at a bar. And we ended up hooking back up together, and he ended up getting me into treatment a little bit later on. We hooked up together, and we didn't spend any time apart except for when he was at work. And I was not in love with him, and he was not in love with me, and we had talked about that, but it just didn't hurt when we were together. You know, he was had gone through a divorce, and I'd gone through a breakup, and we just didn't want to hurt. That was what we were after. And my drinking and drugging had gotten to the point where I couldn't catch a buzz anymore without blacking out. And so I pretty much lived in a blackout for the majority of the time. The police were looking for me after I had hit several cars in a parking lot. I had no recollection of it whatsoever. I had like a drunk car. I mean, it had so many bangs and dents and all that kind of stuff on it that you couldn't tell if you hit anything or not, you know. And I had Sean and I were Mama and my parents had given me a new car. They had given me like a Honda CRX, and he was driving my new car on Father's Day and ran it into a telephone pole, and I went through the windshield. And I got a scar on my face. And I like came to, and he's like, Wendy, are you dead? Are you dead? I'm like, no, I'm not dead, but mate, we were like right by a car wash. And I'm like, mate, that water stop falling on my face. He says, Wendy, that's not water, that's blood. And so, however, he got the car started and got me to University Hospital and got me stitched up. And his father said he would take care of all the trouble that we were in and that he would get the car fixed, but Sean was going to have to go to treatment. And Sean had already, he had been sober. He had had a couple of years sobriety when I met him, but he didn't stay sober that long hanging out with me and the people he was hanging out with. At that point, he said he thinks he's really going to try this time to get sober and try this time for real. And I said, well, what am I going to do? I said, I can't keep on living like this either. I said, you think I'm alcoholic and drug addict? And he said, that's a choice you're going to have to decide on your own. He said, I know I'm alcoholic and drug addict, and you do drugs and drink just like I do, if not worse sometimes. And so so we ended up both going into treatment. And he went on, he just got detoxed. And I went on, the day I went into treatment, my dad took me up there. I hadn't even been without drugs or alcohol for 8 hours, I don't think. And they're like, just taking vital signs and stuff like that. And they're like, stick your tongue out to look down my throat. Me, my tongue was in DT. She's like, oh my God, your tongue's in DTs. I mean, it was just shaking, you know. And they're like, what were you on? I said, I just drank, smoked a little pot. I didn't bother to tell them that I had been shooting Dilaudid every day, was taking about 10 Xanax a day, was drinking every day and smoking pot every day. I didn't tell them that. I told them, oh, my dad was standing right there, so I was just drinking and doing a little pot, that's all. So that's what they detoxed me for. And I got out of the detox or whatever, and I got on the unit, and we were watching some, I think, Father Martin videos or something that was, like, real boring and at the time to me. And my eyes started rolling back in my head. I was, like, going into seizures and didn't think that I should tell anybody, you know. And I was, like, sitting there trying to watch the video. My eyes were rolling in the back of my head, and I was, like, looking down at the floor and seeing the TV. And my teeth were all gritting, and somebody looked at me and they said, God, Wendy, you look like hell. You need to go see the nurse. So they walked me. I was at Doctor's Hospital at St. D now, St. Dominic's now, and walked me across to the unit. And there, at that time, I went to like a grand mal seizure or something like that. And they were fixing to shoot my arm with some Haldol and liquid Valium or something like that, and they looked at it and they said, this is a junkie, don't give her the pleasure. And they ended up giving it to me in my butt, you know, and I just had to sit there gritting my teeth for a while. But it was at that point that there was no doubt, you know, that I was alcoholic and drug addict. I had taken step one at that point, and but it wasn't enough. And I continued on and in the treatment program doing whatever they asked me to do. And it was getting close to the end of the 28-day period, and they gave me a choice. They said, you can either get out and work the program through Alcoholics Anonymous, but we suggest that you go on to this treatment center called COPAC, where you can stay a while, and they can teach you how to stay sober and live sober and give you some more time. Well, easy decision for me, you know, I want to get out, and I'll just get sober in AA. And they made me think that I had a choice, and then I said, no, well, you really don't have a choice. Your parents chosen that you go on to COPAC, so they'll be picking you up on Saturday and taking you straight to COPAC. Well, when I went into Doctor's Hospital, Shauna told me, whatever you do, don't go to COPAC. You know, you'll end up being in that treatment center for a year. And so I was, like, freaking out, you know, and called my parents at home. No, I can't go to COPAC. I'll get sober on my own in AA. And they're like, no, absolutely not. We're picking you up on Saturday, and we're taking you to COPAC. Well, they hadn't said no to me all my life. I'd always pretty much gotten whatever I wanted, and I freaked, and was sitting in group the following day, and I think it was like the Friday. I was getting out the next day or something like that, and this car salesman guy, Randy, I could recognize him. I don't know, he's somewhere, but anyway, he's like, he just thought that was horrible. And I told him all the stuff Sean had told me about COPAC. He's like, God, you don't need to go there. And so he gave me all the money he had in his pocket and covered for me while I ran away. And at that time, they were building that parking garage over there. It wasn't built yet. So, I mean, it had been raining and it wasn't but nothing, a pile of mud over there. And so I left with my big book. I was going to show them. I was going to stay sober. And left with the clothes on my back and my big book, and crawled up that hill. By the time I got up that hill, I was covered in mud. Cut-through university hospital, and the campus police were going about, and I thought they were after me, man. I was, like, freaking out, so paranoid. And so I, like, crossed the street, and there's, like, Murrah High School, and I start crawling across the field like I'm in Vietnam or something. And I get to Bellhaven area and go to these friends of mine, house, Will and Patience, and I knock on the door, and I'm, like, covered in mud, and I got my big book in my hand. They're like, oh, my God, what happened to you? And I told them this horrible story, and they're like, oh, you did the right thing. We're, like, so glad you came to us. And so I come in, I get cleaned up, and I get dressed, and they're like, you want to smoke some pot? And I said, no, I'm going to stay sober. You know, I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to call. I got some phone numbers in my book. I'm going to make some phone calls, and I'm going to stay sober. So I made some phone calls, wasn't anybody home, and called Sean. He wasn't home, left a message. Went to the refrigerator to get a glass of water or something, and there was some imported beer in there, and I thought, well, it'd be all right just to have one. And there you go. You know, all it takes is just one to set off our allergy. And so I drank that one, took the money the car salesman gave me, and we went and bought a case of beer and started smoking pot and drinking beer, and it was the 4th of July. I had declared my independence, and we thought that was so funny. And anyway, Sean called me back, and I told him what had happened. I said, but you might not want to come pick me up now because I've relapsed. And he said, well, that's okay. I've relapsed too. So he came, picked me up, and he was going to take care of me since he's the one that got me in all that trouble. And within a couple of days, we were out of money. We were sitting in his apartment, and he was going to steal some Kool-Aid so that we could make some shrooms. And I was sitting there. I was wearing, like, boxer shorts. I didn't have any of my clothes. I didn't have any of my stuff. And I had no money, and it was like I had started a relationship with God at Doctor's Hospital. I had begun to pray. And I sat in there, and I felt so far from God, and I felt so alone, and I felt so scared. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like, I said, God, I know you probably don't even want to listen to me right now after all that I've done, but I don't know what to do. And I picked up the phone, and I called my parents' house, and my brother answered the phone. He had come from Louisiana to find me. My parents were like putting a second mortgage on their house to hire a private investigator to see if they could track me down. They thought I had probably gone to Florida. But he said, where are you? I'm coming to pick you up. And I said, I'm not going to tell you where I am because I'm not going to Copac, at least not till Monday. So I like got to the point, well, at least not till Monday. I mean, I was hungry. I hadn't eaten in a couple of days. And he says, you don't understand. He says, I've got a fifth of Jack Daniels. And I got a shotgun, and I'm fixing to drink this fifth of Jack Daniels, and I'm fixing to go to Ricky and Alice's apartment, and if they don't tell me where you are, I'm going to blow Ricky away. I've been looking for an excuse. This will give me a good excuse. And now my brother's got 6 years in the program. He said what I didn't know was that he had already had a fifth of Jack Daniels when I was talking to him. But anyway, so I ended up, and I was like, well, I don't want them to get blown away, and he'll do it. So I told him, well, come on, pick me up on Old Fannin Road. And so my brother came, and he picked me up, and he took me to get something to eat, and he took me to have my last beer, and I went to my parents' house. And when I walked in my parents' house, it was at that time that I think I realized for the first time the pain that I had caused them. I walked in, and they were both crying. They were both just so relieved and so happy that I was okay. And that's, you know, they weren't mad or anything like that. They were just relieved that I was okay, that I was alive. And I stayed with them till Monday. And they took me to Copac on Monday. And I was so afraid when I got there. I mean, I had not done anything without drugs and alcohol for so long that even talking to other people was just like I didn't know what to do, you know, without alcohol or without drugs. And they were, like, asking me just simple questions like, what's your name? And, like, my voice was quivering. I was so afraid, and I was so filled with fear, and I was so shy without drugs and alcohol. And I did whatever they asked me to do. I didn't talk to any people really that much. I just did whatever they asked me to do, and I was rocking along, but I still had not yet had the desire to stay sober. And I just remember sitting in treatment, y'all, and we'd be having big book studies, and I was just in such a fog. My head was just so filled with cloud, you know, a cloud, a drug fog, or whatever, you know, that I could not understand. People would comment on what they read. I would read something, and I wouldn't have a clue of what I just read. I could not comprehend what was going on. I was just like, you know, and I knew that I was supposed to be, is what, and it's just that I knew, I just thought that, man, I just have fried my brain. And I guess I had been at Copac for about 3 months, and I got a phone call from my mom, and she said, "Wendy, you need to sit down. I got something to tell you." And I didn't bother sitting down like she told me to, and she told me that Sean had overdosed and he was dead, and I fell down. Lenny knees go out, and for the first time without drinking, I experienced a pain that I had never experienced a pain so intense. And I did not know how to handle it without drugs and alcohol. But fortunately, there were people who loved me through it. And it hurt, you know. And I oftentimes thought, well, you know, it should have been me. I didn't have any children, you know, at the time. And it should have been me. Why was it him? Why couldn't it have been me? Why couldn't his daughter have a father, you know, and going through all that stuff. And that's when I first began to realize what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about living life on life's terms without drugs and alcohol and not having to live it alone. There were people that were there for me, people that would sit with me and hold my hand and listen to me and just hold me. I didn't have a whole lot to say, you know, but they might just hold me. And they saw me through it. And it was at that point, you know, I believe that God can bring good out of everything. You know, I don't necessarily believe that everything is God's will. I believe that a lot of the stuff that has happened in my life as a result of the choices I've made. And a lot of the choices I've made have not been God's will. And so I bought a lot of consequences on myself. You know, they're not from God, they're from me and my choices. And but God can still bring good out of it. I don't believe if Sean hadn't died, I don't believe I'd be standing here sober today. And I sure wouldn't be standing here sober with 11 years. It was at that point that I began to realize the ramifications of the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. I didn't understand it before. You'd have thought I would. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. But for me, it took having somebody close to me die in order for me to be able to live. And I believe that's what God brought out of that situation that was good for me. And it was most of the people at my age at that time were in Copac for a year. I ended up getting out after 7 months because of the change that took place. You know, there was a spiritual awakening that took place after Sean's death. I got out of treatment and moved in with a girl that I was in treatment with. And they told you, you know, get a home group, get involved in AA, get a sponsor. Don't get in a relationship for a year. I got a home group. I got a sponsor. And I got in a relationship within 2 weeks. I was living with them within 3. And I did not have a clue of who I was. I was a little girl who was just getting sober, whose brain had just begun to defog. And I had no idea who I was, what I wanted to do, or anything. And here I was involved in a relationship. And I ended up marrying that man and didn't end up divorcing him until a couple of years ago. But so got involved in a relationship within early sobriety. And I thought, and I mean, I convinced my parents that it was a good thing because he had 6 years of sobriety. And if you have 6 years of sobriety, you got to be doing something right. And guys and girls, I mean, it doesn't matter how many years of sobriety you have in the program or how many days you have in the program, that there are people that we'll find in Alcoholics Anonymous that are sick. And, you know, if we don't do what the big book talks about doing, then we're not going to have the promises. We may, you know, there's a nun that's an alcoholic that talks about the different levels of sobriety. And there are some people that come in through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and they get sober, they stop drinking, life gets better, they're not in jail, they're not pissing in their pants, they're not throwing up, and they're not having hangovers, and they think life is good, and they stop there. Well, that's not all this program has to offer. It has so much more. And we ended up living together and getting married, and I ended up going back to school, decided I got a job at Gaffer's before I left treatment. It was a clothing outlet, clothing store. And I worked there for like until I graduated college. I went to Heinz and I took 2 classes because I was afraid to spend any more of my dad's money on college because I was afraid I had burnt too many brain cells up and that I wasn't going to be able to learn, I wasn't going to be able to pass. But I thought, well, I'll try 2 classes and see what happens. Well, I tried 2 classes, and I made A's, and I got a little confidence that I might be able to do this college thing. And I started out in journalism, but it didn't feel right. and began to do some of the things that they talk about doing in the program. And they, you know, talk about praying, asking God, you know, what do you want me to be, God? And so I prayed, and I mean, he didn't come out of a burning bush and say, be a teacher. But, you know, through a series of events and over a few months' time, I realized that I had a gift working with children. And I worked at Gaithers, and I worked in the children's department. And, you know, just some things happened. This child came up to me and ran to me one day and just wanted me to hold her. And the mother looked at me, and she had a tear coming out of her eye. She said, that's the first time she's ever gone. She won't even go to her daddy. She said, you know, there was something she had. She was disabled in some kind of way or something. And the woman looked at me, and she says, you got a gift. And I took that as kind of God sent, you know, sending somebody. And that wasn't the only thing that happened. You know, there were some other things that happened. So I decided, well, I went and talked to my advisor, and she's like, well, why don't you just take, you know, an introduction to education course and just see what you think about it. And you can take it as an elective, and if, you know, you don't like it, you don't have to stay in it. And it's kind of like when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked in that room, I sat down, and I felt like I was at home. And I took that course, and I was just happy as I could be. I loved it. I loved all that it was, the everything. And so I began to major in elementary education, and that's how I got into my career. I ended up transferring from Hines out to Bellhaven on a scholarship, and Bellhaven changed my life in some other ways. And while I was out there, I got involved in some mission work and ended up going over to Mexico and building water wells and showing the people how to treat the water so that they wouldn't get sick, you know, with dysentery and different things like that, and tried to start learning how to speak Spanish, and wanted to change my career from being in education to being a missionary, but I was married at the time, and my husband wasn't interested in missionary work, so I ended up staying and teaching. But anyway, I loved it, and I began, my relationship with my higher power began to grow and onto a deeper level, and I began to change, you know. I began to come out, something that I had problems with, you know, in early sobriety, and probably for the first couple of years of sobriety, is just fear and shyness, and having to let go of a lot of that was real. I mean, it was just a God process, you know. It's progress, not perfection, and it was, you know, through constant prayer and work with a sponsor and just getting out there and doing things that helped change that. And Bellhaven helped, you know, a lot of that stuff. And I saw a lot of miracles happen while I was out there in Mexico and in a girls group that I was in, that we would get together in somebody's dorm room and pray once a week. And I just saw all kinds of things, you know, happen. Saw God working in my life and in the lives of others, of people that, you know, God, to that point I thought, well, you know, people can't really have a real spiritual contact with God unless they're in some kind of 12-step program. That's what I thought. But I saw people that, you know, actual, quote, normal people that did, you know. And that was a neat experience. And I ended up graduating from Bellhaven with honors, and we moved to Pickens, Mississippi, and I taught first grade for a couple of years at Holmes County Schools. And it was kind of like initiation to the teaching profession by fire. It was pretty stressful, but I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. And I thought that everything was pretty much okay in our marriage. I didn't see my husband very much, you know, for the years that I was in college. It took me about five years to get through college. I worked at Gaithers. I cleaned three houses, and I went to school full-time. I worked at Gaithers full-time, and he was working a couple of jobs, and we just never didn't see each other. And then we get out there, and he was working a lot, and we didn't see much of each other. And he ended up transferring, and we ended up moving to Starkville. And I mean, man, I wanted a baby. I wanted a baby. I had finished college. I was ready to have a baby. He wasn't real thrilled about having a baby. But anyway, you know, I kept pushing and kept pushing and kept pushing, and I couldn't get pregnant. It took me almost a year to get pregnant. And it was a stressful time having moved, and I couldn't find a teaching position up there. And I had a job lined up with somebody that I had known when I was drinking and using, and who was in AA up there at the time and had a company up there, and he was going to give me a job if I couldn't find a teaching job. But I didn't want to be in the cellular phone business. You know, I wanted to do what God was calling me to do, or what I felt like He was calling me to do. And I found out that I was pregnant. And, man, I was, like, so excited. Because I had, in the back of my mind, thought that because of all the drug use that I had done, that I had just messed my body up and wasn't going to be able to have a baby. And I got in my car to drive to Columbus to tell my husband that we were going to have a baby. And this is going to be so silly. But anyway, this is what happened. Bob Dylan was on the radio, and Sean and I used to listen to Bob Dylan, and I thought, just kind of got that warm feeling, and I thought, you know, you're an angel up there looking out after me, aren't you? And then I was like sitting here talking to myself, no, that's silly, you know. But if Santana comes on the radio next, then I'll know it's true. No, it did. It did. I was like sitting down and going down the road crying, oh my God. But it was great, and went to my husband, and he didn't believe me. He said, well, are you going to go to a doctor and get a test? But anyway, I did, and they did the same test I did, and I was pregnant. So anyway, we ended up, his job wasn't working out up there, and I couldn't find a teaching job, so I was, like, too far from home. I wanted to get back to Jackson, and so I said, well, I'm going to go to Jackson, I'm going to look for a job down there, and if I find something, then we can just move down there. And the company he was working for was going to be opening up place down in Pearl, so if, you know, if they could transfer him in a few months. Jackson Public Schools had like over 60 openings. I went on 3 job interviews, and the 3rd job interview I got hired, and that's where I've been ever since. And I work at a school, and now I'm teach special ed, and that was something that I felt like, originally, you know, I had wanted to go into special ed, and my husband said, you know, he didn't think I could handle it, and I listened to him, and I didn't. And then the principal that I work for now is just real encouraging, and I had told him that I was interested in it, and he was going to find a way for me to go to school to get certified without me having to pay a dime. And he said, if that's what you want to do, I'll back you 100%. And so we started checking into it to see how much it was going to cost. They said, well, look, if you hold an elementary certificate and you want to teach special ed, if you can learn the material, you can take a test and get certified. And so I went back to the dean at Bellhaven and got some books, and I went and sat in some special ed classrooms and talked to some teachers and got copies of the law and studied. And I went and took that test, and I turned it over to God. I said, look, I've done the footwork. If this is what your will is for me, then it'll happen. And I get in that room, and, man, people were in there for the 5th and 6th time taking that test. They said it was hard. You know, that doesn't anybody ever pass it the first time. And I went in the bathroom, and I said a prayer, and I said, I'm just going to give it to you. And I took the test, and I got it back, and aced it, man, just blew the roof off of it. And I just took it as that was a sign that I was right where God wanted me to be. And people look at what I do today. I mean, I do home visits. I go into the worst sections of town. I mean, I've walked into people's apartments. My parents often don't have phones. And that's not going to stop me, man. I'm going to help their kids no matter what. And I go to their houses, I knock on their doors, and I talk to them. And I get them involved in their child's education. And I've gone into where they've been smoking pot and whatever. You know, you could still smell it in the background. I'm like, could you step outside and talk to me for a minute, you know? I want to get that contact buzz. But anyway, you know, and the parents have gotten used to me, and they like me. And, I mean, I got a letter last year that just, man, it just was awesome. It made it all worthwhile. I had a child that was IQ of about 62 and had been in special ed since he was in 1st grade, and he was in 5th and hadn't been able to read. And I had him reading, and I had him taking books home, reading to his mama. And she sent me a letter to school telling me that she loved me, and she couldn't thank me enough for the gift that she had given her son and her by giving him that opportunity to learn how to read. And, you know, it makes it all worthwhile. And to me, people's like, how do you do what you do? It's got to be so stressful. And it's not. It's just not. I feel like when we find the gifts that God has given us and use them in our lives, I mean, I just feel so fortunate and so blessed to have found something that I just love to do. And I don't find my job to be stressful. It is at times. You know, it is at times. But I love what I do, and it's just rewarding. And I like the vacation time, too. But anyway, a couple of years ago, things had really gotten bad in my marriage. Things had gotten really bad, and I was very unhappy. My child was afraid. I was afraid. And we were living in a situation that was abusive, and it had been that way for quite some time. And I got to the point where I just couldn't live like that anymore. And I called a friend of mine crying, and I said, I don't know what to do. I can't live like this anymore. And she said, well, you know, you'll always have choices. And I did know that. I thought when I said I do that I did for life, and you know, I still believe that to a certain extent, but our marriage had been over for quite some time. And it got worse before it got better. But I went and I talked to a lawyer, and when I sat down, and for the first time, I mean, I sat in his office for 2 hours, and we talked, and he said, I just want you to start from the beginning and tell me everything that's happened. And he sat there, and he listened to me, and we got done with it, and he's like, do you want to live like that anymore? And I'm like, you know, crying, no. Hell no. I don't want to live like that anymore. And so I began to take steps to leave, and I left my husband on September the 25th, 1998, and it was the best gift that I think I've ever given myself. I haven't missed him. It's been a relief. And it did get worse before it got better, you know, as in a lot of situations like that. And I had to get a restraining order. We've been through to court several times, but I've got full physical and legal custody of my child. I've got a home, and I'm happy today. And it was a painful, painful process, and I had to do a lot of inventory to see what part I played, because you know, I'm responsible for the choices I make in my life, and I'm not going to be anybody's victim anymore. I made those choices, and I've stayed where, you know, when I probably shouldn't have. And I ended up doing a couple of fourth and fifth steps through the divorce process, and it ended up not being enough. I ended up having to go seek a therapist, and I went and saw a therapist, and I did some intense inventory work. I mean, we didn't just do it through the marriage. We went through childhood. We did all that kind of stuff. And I saw her for over a year. And I did everything she asked me to do. I didn't care what it was. I told her when I picked up the phone, I was in to that teachable point. I said, I don't want to leave any stone unturned, no skeleton in my closet. I want to get everything out in the open because I do not want to repeat the same mistakes that I have made this far. I want to be free. You know, I know that the problems that I have created by the choices that I've made. And I don't want to, you know, have to repeat those patterns anymore. And we did. We did some intense stuff. I had, you know, she told me that I had post-traumatic stress syndrome or something. I said, people that go to war have that, you know. And she's like, yeah, right. And so we had to do some exercises to help me get through that. You know, I would go to where I would start hyperventilating and just stuff like that. You know, I was a mess. And I did whatever it took because I wanted to become a whole person and I wanted to be that mama that my baby deserves. I feel like that, you know, I know as a teacher that kids are going to do what we do, not what we say. My husband and I had to live with my parents for a few years, and I would see things in my mama. And man, they would get on my nerves and they were like in me. It was like looking in a mirror. And I knew that I had picked those things up whether I wanted them or not. Just something a little simple like my dad, you know, he'd get something out of the kitchen cabinet and he leaves the door open. And, you know, we'd always like, oh, Dad's been in the kitchen again, you know. I get to move into a house of my own and I come in the kitchen and the cabinet doors are open and I'm like, Dad hadn't been here, you know. It's like I picked up that from him. You know, no telling how long I've been doing it, but just those little things we pick up from our parents and from the people that we hang out with. You know, if I could pick up something little like that, all those other, you know, dysfunctional things that we do, we're going to pick up. My baby's going to pick up for me. So I'm trying to be as healthy as I can be. You know, do whatever I have to do, and my child can grow up in a healthy home and perhaps have those tools to live life on life's terms without drinking and doing drugs. And you know, that's what I can do. The best gift I can give my son is to take care of myself and do whatever I have to do to make sure that I'm a whole person. Because in relationships, you know, we get involved with people. If we're not a whole person, we're going to be trying to take from that person to fill in that emptiness. And they're going to, if they're not a whole, we'll attract somebody else that's not whole. And they're going to be taking from us something to try to fill the emptiness. And that's, you know, we get into codependent relationships like that. And they become draining. And I don't want to be in any kind of relationship that's draining. I want to be in a relationship where I can add to, and that person adds to my life. When it starts to become draining, then it's unhealthy. And, you know, I started going to Al-Anon when I first left my husband, because there was, he ended up switching addictions. And Al-Anon taught me a lot. And one of the things it did teach me is that, you know, to love myself, I would feel guilty to put myself first. And I lost myself. I didn't hardly have, I had a few friends, a few, you know, my sponsor and one other girlfriend when I left. And now I just got a wealth of friends today. You know, when you're on an airplane and the oxygen mask drop, you know, are you going to take that oxygen mask and give it to all the people sitting around you? No, because you can't help those people if you're dead and you're not breathing or you're unconscious. You're going to have to put that oxygen mask on your mouth first so that you can breathe. Then you can help the people around you. You know, I've got to take care of myself first, because if I'm not healthy, I don't love myself, then I don't have anything to give back to anybody else. I don't have anything but unhealthiness and dysfunction to give back. But if I'm healthy and I love myself, then I can give that away to the people around me. And that's what this program has given me today. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Hugh had asked me to speak a couple of weeks ago. And he's like, well, you going to bring your guitar? You going to bring your guitar? Because when I spoke at the woman's meeting, I had picked my guitar back up through the divorce process and ended up kind of using it like a journal and expressing my feelings and thoughts and stuff like that, and have written some songs. And I had sang one of my songs at the woman's meeting, which was much smaller, I mean, under 20 people, and in that room over there. And I was like, no way. I said, I'll come talk, but there is no way I'm going to play my guitar and sing in front of all those people. And then I got thinking about it, and I'm like, well, when has Hugh ever said no to AA? I don't know of a time. And so I can't believe I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it for Hugh, because he hadn't said no to AA.